The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul, your host. We're about to discuss single-family rentals with Brian Mitz, who serves as Chief Financial Officer at NexPoint Residential Trust, among other roles and titles. Brian Mitz, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I've been looking forward to this because single-family rentals is one of those categories of real estate that I've been hearing a fair amount about lately, and also that they're performing quite well, that it's a hot category. Let's start, though, with a couple of the basics. How do you define a single-family rental?
Yes, it seems like it should be a pretty easy definition. Obviously just a house itself that is rented is a single family rental, but I would say any portfolio of size includes duplexes, quadplexes as well. Not a lot of them, but that does fall into that definition. I think that the key difference between a single family rental dwelling is there's no shared amenities in a single family rental versus in a multifamily. You typically have some kind of shared amenity, whether it's a pool, clubhouse, gym, whatever it may be.
So what is the scale at this point of single family rentals? What's the size of that single family rental market in the United States?
It's really very large. I'd say it's the largest real estate sector. I think there's about 17 million households that live in a single-family rental property. That's, I think, about 55% of the total rental market. So the remainder is that multifamily piece. So it's a very large segment. But today, throughout history, it's not been very institutionalized, meaning most owners are owners that only own a handful of houses versus large portfolios.
When you talk about a market of that size, though, Brian, you're talking about the entire rental market. You're not talking about the investable market. I mean, it's investable in that if I own a home, I can rent it out. But when you're talking about institutional investors or high net worth individuals, how many units are we talking around the country that's actually part of this trend towards almost a new property type that's investable?
Yeah, it's a great distinction. The investable universe is probably less than a million houses. And really, if you look at widespread investing, you've got today three publicly traded, four if you add one that's kind of doing single family rental as well as other, but you only have a few companies that you can invest in widely. The rest of it is private, such as Vinebrook, which we manage. And then you've got what people call the mom and pop, which isn't investable by the public. So yeah, it's less than a million homes in total. It's a pretty small market from that perspective.
So the real issue then is the growth of that market. Is it scaling up quickly? Is this an area of real estate that's growing fast? Is that what makes it interesting?
Yeah, it's growing very fast, and that's a trend that we've seen developing since post-2008 crisis. I would say that the reason you're hearing so much about it today is that as we come out of the COVID crisis, it's a trend that's accelerated. I think post-2008, it became very difficult for a lot of people to buy a house. They couldn't afford it. They couldn't get the financing. They couldn't put down the down payment. And lending restrictions or constraints didn't really ease that much. And then we're kind of back into that with this COVID issue. So I think you've had a generation that's kind of grown up with two shocks to the housing market that today is just not likely to buy a house, whether it's for financial reasons or just lifestyle choices, where they want more flexibility. They don't want to be tied down by a mortgage or the upkeep and maintenance. You can just turn that over to a landlord. And so I think that's why you hear today so much about single family rental, but it's definitely been a growing sector. It's becoming institutionalized, but it's far from where you see other property types. And you know, to your point earlier, it is a newer sector for sure. That's still developing, still consolidating, still gaining in scale.
So check me on this. My recollection is that when we had the global financial crisis, it was then that there were these just scads of houses that were being scooped up by institutional investors that decided, you know, this, we can go ahead and get these houses shipshape, go ahead and rent them out, and it becomes a source of a running source of income. And that was the trigger point, was it not, for the investable universe of single family rentals, is that that's when the idea kind of dawned on institutional investors and maybe some other investors, smaller scale investors, who just decided, look, all these homes are available. The banks don't want to own these properties. They want to unload them. They're not in the real estate business. They just want to lend for real estate. So why don't we come in and put together a program here?
Yeah, you're exactly right. That's exactly when and how it started. I'd say it a different way a little bit. It started as a value trade where investors knew that there was a disconnect or dislocation in the housing market. You could buy them for much cheaper than they were ultimately worth. In some cases, I think the rental piece of it was sort of secondary. You know, why not make money while we hold these assets while they're appreciating? And so that kind of triggered the real institutionalization of the sector and the ability to invest in that sector without, you know, physically buying a house yourself, fixing it up and trying to rent it out. But yeah, it started in the wake of that 2008 crisis when there was a lot of inventory on the market from banks that had foreclosed or just people trying to sell their house. And it was just cheap prices that people saw an opportunity. And then from there, it's grown into, you know, what I call a real sector, where acquisitions aren't done on the courthouse steps. We're just buying kind of foreclosed deals sight unseen. There's actual, you know, diligence done on houses now, et cetera. But yeah, that's exactly how it started.
Well, that's a good point you're making right there. How do the owners of single family rentals, these investors or investment managers, how do they accumulate homes at this point? Now, there was, like I was saying earlier, scads of them available. Let's just scoop them up in one fell swoop. We'll pay a bunch of money for these homes. Actually, it was, you know, a really good deal at the time because the prices had collapsed. How are homes accumulated today? Are they onesies and twosies, or are the investors able to scoop up dozens at a time?
There's both. I'd say that the majority is probably ones and twos, and the technology is a driver of the sector in general, but specifically around acquisitions, there's a lot of kind of algorithms that have been put in place. People create what they call a buy box, like the different characteristics they want, and then they're basically going on MLS every day as new listings hit in whatever markets they're interested in, and it just automatically putting out an offer if it fits, you know, within your buy box. And then from there, you do a little bit of diligence from a human, but that's how you're able to accumulate houses. And so the rate at which you can accumulate depends on the market you're in and the number of markets that you're in. You know, for example, Dallas is going to have more inventory and turnover than a St. Louis or, you know, a city like that. So that's how the majority are done. There is a consolidation happening in the business where you have maybe not mom and pop, but, you know, larger portfolios where they've realized that appreciation that we talked about earlier. It is hard to operate a portfolio with that many assets in it. So I think at some point an owner-operator realizes that they're not going to get the scale they need to really make a great return. And they've got a lot of appreciation built into their portfolio. So they just sell it to someone else who looking to accumulate those houses. And you're seeing that down the chain to you know, groups that have 10, 15, 20 houses. We buy portfolios and singles you know, almost every day. So you see both of them. And then more rarely you see a combination of really large portfolios. For example, last fall we bought a portfolio of 950 homes in one transaction. That's definitely much more rare than buying the ones and twos and, you know, and then occasionally getting a larger portfolio.
Interesting. So, I mean, I think we've all known people who own 7, 10, 15 homes or rentals of some kind and say, you know, this is kind of my retirement as cash flow. And but at some point they may just decide, you know, I'm at an age now where I don't want to deal with this anymore. I can sell it off to Blackstone or to Apollo or Colony. Did I just name three of the biggest players in the space, Brian? Who are you go ahead and who are the three biggest in the space right now? And this doesn't have to be dead on. We won't quote you on this other than, but you know who the big boys are in this space. Who are they?
Yeah. So Invitation Homes is the largest. They have about 90,000 homes. They are public. They were a creation of Blackstone that aggregated some different portfolios together. Some of those were Starwood and Colony that they kind of aggregated to become the largest. The second largest is American Homes for Rent. There are about 55,000 homes. They're also publicly traded. And then from there, you have one more publicly traded company. Actually, Tricon has some as well. They're public, but Front Yard Residential is the third public company. They're 15,000 homes, and you do have private operators that are larger. There's some that are kind of 20 to 30,000 homes that have been assembled by some private equity groups, but that's about it. You have kind of a handful of players above 10,000, maybe a handful more above 5,000, and then it kind of drops off pretty sharply.
One of the criticisms of this whole single-family rental program or effort back when it first got started was, you're going to have single-family homes scattered all over the place. Renters don't take care. Have you ever rented, Brian?
Yeah.
Have you rented a single-family home before?
No, only an apartment.
Okay. Well, I've rented single-family homes, and I treat it like it's my own because, you know, I'm always of the mind that, you know, if you take care of the place, the landlord doesn't raise the rent. Not true if it's a property management firm. They do it like clockwork, unfortunately. So I went back to home ownership again, but there are a lot of people say, you know, renters don't take care of the property, number one. Number two, when it comes to maintenance, you have properties scattered all over the place. It's different if you've got an apartment complex where everything is all one building or a couple buildings. It's all on one compound. And if you've got maintenance workers, you might even have full-time maintenance workers who keep everything up to grade. What about single family rentals, though? Is an effort made to keep all of those homes aggregated in some fashion so that they're within close proximity to one another? And is the expense on maintaining those homes, let's say somebody moves out, first thing you have to do is go into that home and make sure that it's up to snuff before you try to rent it again. Is the upgrade, not even an upgrade, is the maintenance on these homes more expensive than, say, if you've got an apartment complex?
Yeah, so I'll start with kind of that concentration or lack thereof and how you tackle that from a maintenance perspective. Technology is a big factor in being able to you know, schedule your maintenance people efficiently and effectively. Obviously, training, just having good people on staff that are able to do the types of repairs. I'd also say that the way in which you assemble your portfolio is important and where you assemble it. If you're in a smaller city that isn't as spread out, you know, obviously it's a little bit easier because you're right. No matter what you do, you're going to have houses scattered kind of throughout. But at the same time, I think a lot of operators in a quest for diversification, geographic diversification, have not been concentrated enough. And so it makes it harder to really get scale in any single market. So the way you assemble your portfolio is important. And then the other piece of that is, I think, the turnover, which you talked about. What's that cost? The turnover cost, meaning when one tenant leaves and you do whatever you need to do for the next tenant, is more expensive than an apartment, but cheaper on a per square foot basis. And the retention in a single family rental is so much higher, meaning, you know, your average tenant may stay 2.5-3 years, whereas in an apartment, it's probably 1.5 years, maybe less. So you're turning over that apartment unit much more. So ultimately, you end up spending more money in the apartment. As far as taking care of the home, I think there's definitely that segment of renter that won't take care of it. But if you're buying, you know, the proper properties and the proper neighborhoods with proper underwriting of the tenants, I think by and large what you find is they do take care of it because they do tend to stay 3 years or so. And so they want to live in a nice place. You know, if you get routine maintenance issues from a tenant, you know, that's, you start to kind of look towards eviction because that's not the right tenant. But overall, it is a challenge compared to multifamily, certainly when you're, you know, talking about servicing 300 units on, you know, call it 20 acres or 30 acres versus trying to service 300 homes that could be across, you know, miles and miles. So I think all those things factor in to be able to run it efficiently and to generate the proper margins. But technology is certainly a huge factor in that.
I thought I heard you say staff with regard to maintenance, but you guys don't, the people in the business don't necessarily have staff people on payroll. They're working with contractors. Is that right? Or are there staff people who are actually being sent out to do the maintenance?
Yeah, it's an important distinction, and it's a combination depending on your size in a certain market. But, yeah, you do tend to rely on the trades, you know, plumbing, electrical, HVAC for those types of repairs. So you'd contract out that work. But some of the more basic things are just like you'd have in a multifamily, you have people that are, you know, on your staff, they're on your payroll, they're not contract labor. And then once you have scale, you have managers that are controlling the process and monitoring the process. So it's a combination of the two, but you're correct. You do use and rely on local contractors to help with that because those are specialties. And, you know, in some cases it's pretty detailed. You want a licensed plumber, electrician, et cetera.
And then your staff person may be somebody like the equivalent of a general contractor. That's the person who goes out and identifies the subs and makes sure that they know what the heck they're doing and make sure they're getting the job done right. Is that kind of the model?
Exactly. And managing, you know, the cost of supplies, et cetera, and making sure you're, you know, buying bulk and getting good deals. So, yeah, it's more you GC the work, and then you've got the subs that you rely on that are local. But in many cases, once you get to a sufficient size, a lot of their work, you know, is from you. So they're not full-time, they're not on payroll, but a lot of their income is derived from you and your work orders.
So what about vetting renters? I mean, you've got a place available, you have some people interested. I'm sure that some pretty good care goes into making sure you select somebody who you're confident will stick around and will take care of the property. What is that all about? What's that like? What's that process like?
Yeah, so you're correct. That's a key component in building a good portfolio. And the fair housing laws restricts, you know, some of the things you can do, but what you can do is request criminal background checks, credit checks, and from that you can kind of piece together what type of tenant it is. You also you know, get information on their job and job history, and with that you're able to determine, you know, is this a good credit risk? Because really that's what you're looking at is, are they going to pay their rent? Are they going to pay it on time? Are they going to take care of the property? It's not foolproof. It's not 100%. You certainly have issues. You have people that don't pay. You have people that don't take care of the property. But for the most part, you're able to, if you use that information correctly and you have a diligent process, you're able to find the tenants that are good. And the great news about single-family rental historically now and probably in the even long-term future is demand is so high for the product, you can be very selective. And I think that's the difference between a mom and pop and a more institutionalized company, that if you're kind of renting this thing out and you got a couple of houses, you probably want to fill it really quickly, but don't necessarily have a sophisticated underwriting of the tenants themselves versus someone who does this hundreds of times a month or even more in filling their houses. So I think that's a major distinction between the bigger players and smaller players. But yeah, you can get the right tenant in there and have a pretty successful underwriting given the current environment.
Well, and I know from experience that you can walk into a single family home that's for rent and the place is not up to grade. I'm assuming, of course, that people who are serious about investing, that the investors we're talking about are making sure that the carpet's clean, the walls are painted, the fixtures are in place, the HVAC system works properly. And how high a standard needs to be set there to make sure that people who move in don't turn right around and start complaining about things not working?
Yeah, you need a pretty high standard, and that's one of the challenges, particularly as you get more and more assets on, having a proper inspection regimen, because you are, in some cases, relying on a subcontractor, so you have to be diligent in your selection of those, but then also managing the projects, and it's not just, turning over from one tenant to the other, but, on initial acquisition, many times, particularly if you're buying older homes, they need quite a bit of work. And so you have to have a standard in place to which you bring the houses up to. And I think that goes to the quality of what the resident's receiving. And I think in today's market, you can probably get away with less just because demand is so high. But I think if you're trying to build a long-term business, reputation matters. Particularly as you get more and more scale within a market, you don't want a bad reputation as not providing a good, clean, safe, high-quality resident experience. So I think we do a good job. I'm sure there's others out there that don't do as good of a job. The other thing I think is a big difference we haven't really touched on is there's a lot of third-party management out there, meaning the person who owns the home doesn't really do any of the management. They turn it over to a third party who does all the leasing, maybe does the renovations, does the repairs and maintenance, on an ongoing basis. We tried that many years ago, and it just didn't seem like it was working well. So we've internalized all that. Again, we do use subcontractors in some cases, but for the most part, the people that interact with our residents and run the business in the field or deal with the properties work for us, and we find that to be a better model in this case.
So you mentioned the demand a couple of times. Your words, not mine, and that's what makes this space interesting. But let me ask you this. The reason the demand is vigorous in part is because it's so difficult to own a home just in terms of putting the down payment together. But once you have a down payment together, it's actually cheaper to own a home and pay a mortgage than to pay rent. But there's that high hurdle to putting that down payment together after the global financial crisis. Regulators started realizing, they've got to come up with a big enough percentage of this, of the purchase price. We can't let lenders get into trouble again. Let's say, though, that hurdle comes down for whatever reason, whether regulators get lax or whether the market dynamics change. Is there any fear of that at all, or do you see that as something that, if it happens at all, is a long, long way off?
Yeah, there's definitely a chance of that, but I think the movement away from ownership to renting has been more than just financial. I think in many cases, it's a lifestyle choice. There's more flexibility and optionality if you're a renter. There's also a convenience factor. I mean, you mentioned that you've owned and rented, so you know that if the water heater goes out, it's a lot easier to make a phone call and somebody comes out and it's, you know, taken care of versus as a homeowner, you got to find the plumber, you've got to, you know, pay for all that expense, and it's just it's a convenience thing. And so I think that aside from the financial aspect, there's a sort of generational movement away from ownership to renting for the flexibility, the convenience, just lack of hassle. When you rent, it's kind of all paid for, your taxes, insurance, you know, everything, as opposed to if you're buying and have a mortgage and you got to, you know, escrow the taxes and insurance yourself and kind of arrange for the insurance. And it's just a lot more that goes into it from an ownership perspective.
Well, and I can attest to that, you know, my wife and I decided, both having been homeowners multiple times, decided let's rent. And we couldn't ever get quite in the situation we wanted, so we became homeowners again. But I will tell you that one rental situation in particular, the owner of the home was a contractor, and he just said, anything goes wrong, just call me. I'll get it fixed right away. It was beautiful. The only reason we didn't stay is there was a tremendous amount of road noise that we didn't realize when we had first moved in. But there is that convenience of you get to live in it. Just go ahead and take care of it, and things are taken care of. If you make a phone call, and as long as you have a good landlord, it gets taken care of. So I would imagine turnaround time. This is part of the maintenance thing for any investor organization is let's make sure that our turnaround time, if something goes out, we fix it quickly. There is kind of this maybe different ethos, like you say, especially among young people who are. Maybe looking to be a little bit more mobile, not so fixated on ownership, and maybe just can't get there anyway. So you've given us some reasons why you're optimistic about the single family rental market going forward, Brian. What else would you add to that? Are there any other aspects to this that you would cite as reasons for optimism that this is a market that's going to continue to grow and is going to continue to produce a good outcome for investors?
Yeah, I think demographics always plays a huge part in real estate. And what I'd say is that you have a generation in the millennials that has, you know, high debt from student loans, in, you know, on average, has deferred home ownership or, you know, living in a home at all, having kids, doing even marriage, doing things like that, that are now kind of coming of that age. And it's certainly through COVID, but even before, it's become difficult to own a home, to get that down payment, to, you know, even qualify for a mortgage given the level of debt that they have. And it's a large generation. I mean, there's a lot of people, and there's, I think, a demand at this point for housing, not multifamily, but housing. And so that just creates a huge pool for rental if you're an SFR, because they want a house, they want the privacy, they want the things that come with it, added space, but they just can't afford it or don't want to own a home. And so I think that creates a long-term demand because that generation is, you know, large, and it's just kind of entering that phase, which again has been delayed versus prior generations, but they're entering that phase now. And I think there's just a shortage of kind of quality rental opportunities that'll help companies that can provide that high quality.
Now, you had mentioned, I believe you alluded to consolidation. Is the market ripe for consolidation? Are you seeing it happening right now? What will, and when you talk about consolidation, are you talking about some of the players already involved in it deciding to either merge together or just go ahead and sell their assets? Or are you talking about consolidation as in more of the mom and pop owners just deciding, hey, there's a good payday in this, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to, Starwood or whoever.
It's a little bit of both. The first one where you see kind of bigger players combining has happened. That's how you had Imitation kind of form. That's where Tricon got into the business. They acquired the Silver Bay portfolio. So you've already seen that kind of big institutions acquiring each other. I think now what you're seeing is a lot of the smaller operators are kind of cashing in at the top of the market on whenever they bought, they have a good basis, and so they have a lot of gains built in that they're recognizing. And so I think you're seeing a sophistication come into the marketplace that's just part of the natural evolution as this becomes a bigger and bigger, more institutionalized sector. So you're able to consolidate more easily with those larger companies. And there's another aspect of this, by the way, that's kind of happening. American Homes for Rent is probably the most visible in public, is the build-to-rent kind of movement where you're, buying land. It's more almost like a multifamily, but it's, basically like a housing development. You're creating a housing development that is built for rental. And that's not necessarily a new thing. It's just something that hasn't really been part of the larger institutional SFR space until recently. But, I think between that and, the mom and pop type operators selling, you'll see a large increase in the housing stock for rentals to larger and larger kind of companies and operators in the space.
What's your expectation post consolidation as to the number of major players that will be in the United States? I don't know if that's a fair question or not. You might, I'm not asking you to be a psychic on this, but usually people in the space tend to kind of get an idea of how many players will end up dominating the space. Do you have a number in mind post consolidation, Brian?
Yeah, we, by the way, our platform manages quite a few multifamily units. So we tend to, and I think a lot of people tend to equate SFR to multifamily, and it's gotten them in trouble in the past, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway here. I think over time, this market starts to look like the multifamily market where you've got 10 to 20 publicly traded companies. You've got large national players that are private. And then you've got, a bunch of fairly sizable regional players. I don't know when that happens or exact numbers, but I think it starts to look more like that type of landscape. But I think one of the keys is technology. We own across our portfolio 20-something thousand units, but it's only across like 60-something properties. So we view that as having 60, 65 assets. In our single-family rental portfolio, we have over 8,000 homes. So we have 8,000 individual assets that we have to manage. And so being able to do that effectively and efficiently requires technology, which I think is better today than it was 5 years ago, or is somewhat non-existent. But it's going to be much better in 5 years and 5 years after that, et cetera. So I think as technology develops around this industry, you'll start to see bigger and bigger players, able to kind of form and build this industry out to look more like what you kind of see from a capital markets perspective in multifamily versus just, tons and tons, thousands and hundreds of thousands of these small mom and pop operators.
What do trend lines tell you about how many single-family rentals there are today versus what there will be in 10 years or 20 years? Now, trend lines change. I get that. But why don't you repeat, Brian, what you said earlier, because I don't remember the exact number, how many SFRs there are in the market right now. And as you project out 10 or 20 years, can you make some kind of guesstimation as to what the number will be in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, so the number today is around 17 million rental homes. If you, I guess, go back you know, to history to predict the future. Since 2008, that's that kind of stock has grown by about 30%. Multifamily is closer to 15%. So rental is growing, you know, across the board, but single family rental is growing faster. I would expect that trend to continue. I don't know if it'll be 30% over the next 10 years, but it's going to grow. And I think part of it isn't, you know, new rentals created as much as maybe taking it from a smaller operator and moving it into the platform of a larger operator. And I think thereby making it a better product in general. And so I think the number of people renting is going to increase. And I think single family rentals is going to be the biggest beneficiary versus multifamily, simply because it's not as big. I mean, the law of numbers and averages is going to help single family rental, but I think it'll be a pretty large market in the next 10, 20 years. I don't know what the demographic shift is going to be that will change that. I'm sure there's something. It appears that COVID has, you know, changed a lot of things or accelerated them in the real estate world. I think people were, and for the last 10, 20 years, been moving more into the urban core. It seems like that's, you know, on a dime reversed 180 degrees where people are looking to move out of the urban core. So things like that can change very quickly, obviously. But sitting here today, what we know today, it seems like single family rentals, I think, well set up for a very long runway over the next decade or two, and could grow, you know, another 30% in 10 years or 25%. But I think it's going to be pretty healthy growth and probably some of the best in real estate.
So when you talk about the number of rentals, you mentioned 17 million, but those 17 million are not in the investable universe, right? It's a smaller
Correct.
Number. So what is it again, did you say, is owned by investors or, you know, investment managers?
I would say, you know, what's owned by that group where you could invest in it, either, you know, broad-based through the public markets or through private investments, is probably a million or less.
Okay,
now,
so
I don't think that grows 5x over the next, you know, 10 years.
Okay. All right. So it could be as much as like 5 million.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I noticed that NexPoint has single family rentals primarily in the Midwest. Is there anything about operating in the Midwest that is unique or particularly advantageous?
Yeah, it's, you know, real estate in general, particularly at the institutional level, has a very coastal bias. I think that you look at Midwest markets in general, and they're not high growth markets. A high growth market today would be your largest cities in the Sun Belt markets. In the Midwest, there's still growth. You've seen a stabilization since the manufacturing jobs in the 80s were kind of, you know, decimated. It stabilized there. It's still growing, not as much, but it has a pretty large shortage of housing, certainly affordable housing, which is what we focus on. You have lower cost of doing business in those markets, and you have the ability to, on a percentage basis, to push rents much more aggressively than you do in some of these coastal markets, particularly now. I think COVID has really set back those coastal gateway markets in their ability to not only raise rent, but they're looking at declining rents in those markets. So I think you have that bias. You don't have a lot of institutional focus on the Midwest or kind of the flyover country. So there's lower competition for us. There's more availability that, you know, we're not competing with other investors. We're competing with home buyers, basically. And that's a declining population. So we think that you can get better value there, and the ability to grow your cash flows faster and more in that market and not compete with other, you know, large institutional players who theoretically should have a better cost of capital, but we're not having to compete with them.
And I would imagine when you have a big downturn, the Midwest doesn't get slammed the way coastal cities get slammed. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you go back and look at the last few recessions, you don't see the big run-up in home prices, but you don't see the big drop either. And really, we're less concerned about home price appreciation or depreciation. We're concerned on what cash flow can we generate from those assets. And I think over time, we were able to and have been historically able to generate a very consistent cash flow stream from those assets with consistent growth, that's maybe not as high as somewhere else, but it doesn't fall as low as other places in a recession. And that's one of the things that we've been touting about this portfolio, and I think it's proven true. It's only, a couple months since we've been in this COVID place, but I think so far we've shown that we've done well. Our collections are higher than they've been historically. So I think it's a good sign for SFR in general and certainly our markets and tenants individually.
So you're in that low volatility American breadbasket. What about performance of the sector? I'm not talking about – I've waited till now, Brian, to ask you this question because I know this is a sensitive question that you might not even be able to answer because there's always the regulators that you need to worry about. And I'm not asking about NexPoint in particular, but overall, the industry, which a lot of people said, this thing's not going to pencil out, it's not going to work in the beginning. A lot of people were poo-pooing it. How has the sector – single-family rentals performed so far?
It's done pretty well. I think initially, a few years ago, you saw some of the bigger players were underinvesting. And what that means is that when you're looking at your NOI and you're determining your earnings, you should back out a certain percentage to go towards ongoing repairs and maintenance, and investing in the asset. I mean, and assets don't just stay the same. It's going to always deteriorate over time, so you have to continually invest in it. Hotels are probably at one end of the spectrum where, every 5, 6, 7 years you have to reinvest a lot. I'd say multifamily, single-family rental are kind of in the middle. Storage would be, on the far side where you don't have to invest that much. So I think one of the knocks on the business was there was not enough being reserved for that future investment. I think that's corrected itself now. And I think on an ongoing basis, it's a very scalable business. Now that everybody's kind of figured it out, they got their arms around it. As I said, the technology is improving. So now you're able to operate these and reserve that amount that you need to invest. And that's been the biggest problem. Another problem, I think, was just the overall cost structure and getting that under control. And I think the larger players are seeing that. So it's easiest to measure performance from a public company. And over time, that should be indicative of the market itself. Obviously, public equities can be very volatile in the near term, as we've seen here recently. But I think if you kind of take that piece of it out, SFR has performed very well. I think the difference between the sector overall and maybe some individual underperformers is just an inability to really manage their platform well and efficiently, because it does take, a very diligent and disciplined process as well as a combination of technology to be able to manage a lot of assets. And if you're even a small operator at 100 assets, that's a lot. And being able to manage that and produce the margins that you need to can be difficult. But I think in general, SFR has done well. I think it's getting better because of these efficiencies that are and scalability that's coming into play. And I think that continues, that trend continues. But I think you will still see, until you get to scale, it is hard for an operator to hit those types of metrics that make it worthwhile.
So efficiency, scalability, are there any other opportunities within the space that you see where a player can boost the performance? Or is it really, does it really revolve around the efficiency and scalability?
Yeah, I think that's the key part of it. There's probably ways to, get better at operations, to improve the technology that'll help. But I think it just gets back to it's a pretty simple business, and the more scale you can get, the cheaper that you can do things, across a larger portfolio. And I think the way we've built our portfolio, where we don't focus on too many markets. Today, we have 12 core markets, and we're able to acquire quite a few houses every month in those markets, so we just continue to get scale. Once you go into a new market, you got to carry that market for a while because you're not going to make any money there until you get, probably 200, 250 homes. So I think that's being able to assemble your portfolio correctly is a huge opportunity that I think some companies have just not done, and now they're scrambling trying to figure out how they manage a portfolio across 50 markets. And it's difficult to do once you've got those assets kind of in play every single day, either cash flowing or not cash flowing.
Yeah, it seems like a tremendous organizational effort. So, Brian, just a few final questions. I want to ask you about leases. One-year lease, do you allow for multi-year leases? Do people get automatic rent increases regardless of what a good tenant they are? Does the lawn and yard service come with that? Because I've seen this over and over where somebody rents and it's like, it's not my yard. And next thing you know, it's just a mess and there was weeds everywhere. So let's parse this out a little bit. Let's start with a lease. I can tell you from my own experience, I was telling a landlord that, listen, this is going to be a long-term rental. I'll sign a three-year lease. She wouldn't agree to that. She as far as she would go is 2 years. Would you sign a multi-year lease? Or is that standard in the industry that they would allow for a multi-year lease? And if you do allow for that, are there automatic cost escalators in there?
Well, I'll give you an interesting answer to that question. You're not going to see it much in a large-scale business, primarily because lenders don't like it. It's too restrictive. It's, I think, historically speaking, rents are going to go up most years. So you're going to want to have the flexibility to increase the rent. The lender is not going to want you boxed into longer-term leases. So they actually limit the number of leases you can have over 13 months. So, yeah, we don't really typically do it. I would say our tenant base that we focus on, there isn't a large demand for it. So it's not a huge issue for us. But, yeah, we're typically not going to have anything over 12 months. Having said that, our retention is pretty high. Our average tenant stays about 36 months. So, yeah, they certainly could, in hindsight, have signed a longer-term lease if we allowed it. As far as rental increases, I think revenue management is one of the areas that has a long way to go in the single-family rental industry. For example, multifamily, I'd say it's down to a science. It's not there yet in single-family, but on balance, you're going to be able to renew a tenant at a higher rent than you would be if you brought a new tenant in. Not always the case. Depends on the market, depends on the home, a lot of different factors, but a lot of times that's the case. And so it's also better because you're not having to spend any money to renew a lease versus if a tenant moves out and you have to, turn over that home and the cost to go into that. And then, the cost of getting a new tenant, there is a cost associated with that. So, I'd say in general, we're going to push a rent increase on every renewal, but it is sort of facts and circumstances and depends on the home and the market, et cetera.
I'm just curious, why would you not why does it not work out if you say a three-year lease is fine, we want you to be a long-term tenant, and each year the rent goes up by 5% or 7% or whatever. Do you still feel like that doesn't give you the flexibility that you need in case the market pricing exceeds that? Is that kind of the idea? I mean, because you can build in automatic rent increases into a lease.
Yeah, which is very standard in, like, you know, typical retail net lease deal. I would say if we could get 7% increases baked into our leases, we'd absolutely do that over a long period of time. But it's not the market, and it's not, I think, realistic to have tenants sign up for that. And despite the fact that our tenants stay for kind of an average of 3 years, I don't think they think they're going to stay for 3 years when they move in. So I think it would be difficult to get to that point, or for them to agree to such a large increase over time.
Got it. How about the yard service? Is that automatically included? You have lawn and yard service to make sure that the property looks good?
In our homes, it isn't. And I don't want that to be interpreted as we're slumlords and our houses aren't well maintained. But our rent point is about $1,000 a month. And I think typically our tenants aren't, you know, generally speaking, used to hiring somebody to do that. They do it themselves. So it's usually not an issue. Across 8,000 houses, clearly you're going to have people that don't take care of their yards, et cetera. But we tend to buy assets in clumps, so we are somewhat concentrated in neighborhoods. So the more we upkeep our homes, the better it is for the neighborhood in general, which allows us to push our rents, et cetera. So instead of paying for it, there is a lot of kind of monitoring and making sure that it's being done. But I think at a higher price point, that's a more common service that's provided, but not at our price point. Our houses are generally kind of 50 to 60,000. We'll put about 20,000 into them initially just to bring them up to that standard that we talked about earlier. And then, we're renting them for $950 to $1,000 a month. So it's not a lot of room in there to pay, you know, somebody $25 or $30 to do the lawn.
Well, what about the expectation that you have with a renter? Is anything written into the contract about taking care of the yard? Now, I'll give you an example. I took care of my own yard when the last time I rented, I'd be mowing the lawn and edging and weeding and all doing all that. And when I moved out, the landlord ended up folding yard service into the lease, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I would have been perfectly happy to pay more money to do that. And at one point, I even asked him, do you know somebody, a good yard service that I can go ahead and hire? I never really got an answer from him, but do you always have those people who are too busy, or they just don't care enough? So do you create any kind of expectation or put anything in the lease that says we do expect that you not only take care of the interior of the property, take care of the yard?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is built into the lease, and you can, you know, turn a tenant over if they fail to do that. It's not the same as destroying the inside of the house per se. It's not as material, but over time it can be. And a lot of the neighborhoods have their own restrictions, or the cities have their own restrictions. And when that fine comes through, it's not to the tenant, it's to us. I mean, we bill it back to them, but, you know, it becomes an issue for us. So yeah, there is an expectation. It's not only documented in the lease, because I'm sure a lot of people don't read their leases or read them in detail, but we convey sort of the expectations to tenants, verbally as we're executing the leases on kind of what we expect, et cetera, just to make it, you know, very clear. We'll provide you a safe, clean place to live that's a high quality. We'll repair and maintain it to the extent that we need to, and you pay your rent, and you take care of your yard, and, you know, you be a good neighbor, and, you know, all those things. So, yeah, we're pretty clear about the expectations, and I think for the most part it works very well. You do have the outliers, but your yard is an important thing because it creates a perception around the homeowner.
Yeah, the reason I make such an issue of it, Brian, is because neighbors start to make phone calls. They start to call and complain because it's like, you know, I've got a mess next door, and talk to your person about doing this or that. Obviously, you know, it hasn't been that big an issue because you've got that handled. One more question having to do with move-in cost. Is it first and last? Is it first and last plus security deposit? What is the safe level for the investor, for the company managing it? What's the safe level of upfront money?
Yeah, we typically try to do for 1 month, first month, and then last month, so basically 2 months of rent. It's some states are cracking down on this, and so it's kind of changing a little bit. But you know, with that, and again, that's not a large number. It's about $2,000 maybe, but you know, we do find that is a decent sized number for our tenants. So if they do a lot of damage or they skip out on a month, it's not necessarily going to cover all of our costs, but it does act as an incentive for them to take care of the property and to not just kind of walk out. And we have been flexible, particularly during this COVID period, on trying to, you know, offer payment plans with tenants. But you know, for the most part, we kind of have you got to pay your rent here, and here's your deposits. And you know, if you can do it, you can. If you can't, you can't. Like I said, you have a lot of ability to be selective in a market like this where we're running, you know, 98% plus occupancy, and there's a lot of demand for what's left.
Oh, at 98%, that's a question I didn't answer or ask, but 98%, that's impressive. Okay. Well, listen, our guest has been Brian Mitts. He is Chief Financial Officer at Next Point Residential Trust. We've been talking about single family rentals, all things rental. And Brian, I would encourage you to sell your home and get into a rental, because my being a new homeowner again has just reminded me of what a headache it is to own a home. I think you'd be much happier in one of your rentals. And I think a lot of people have come to that conclusion, which is why you guys and other companies are in the business and doing well. I jest, but
I've tried that, but I was overruled by my wife and kids.
Yeah. Oh, I get it. That happens from time to time. I really appreciate you taking the time, though. It's such an interesting market, and it's a strong market and a growing market that is always of interest to investors. And you certainly supplied a lot of details today, Brian. So I appreciate it very much. I know our listeners do, because if they're not already invested in that space, it gives them a chance to, it gives them all the information they need to kind of run the calculus on that. So really appreciate your time.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.